Welcome to Sessions by Monster Chats. Sessions is a new kind of show for us where we ditch the script and instead dig into the real stories behind the people in our professional lives. How do we all come together in this world of entrepreneurship, sales, and unified communications? One session at a time. On today's episode, I'm going to be talking with Marie Smith of Data 360. Marie and I are going to be talking about artificial intelligence, women in tech, minorities in tech, and how to partner with global enterprise as a startup. I'm Colin Mitchell, the host of Monster Chats and your founder of Monster VoIP. Marie Smith's ambitious entrepreneurial spirit led her to be a founding contributor in her 20-year career to nearly 50 media, tech, and wellness companies and projects, which have contributed to over 100 million in transactions. As a technology expert in profiling, she has worked with nearly 3,000 brands through various ad agencies, working with Twitter and Facebook pre-IPO on their advertising programs, and been nominated for Rising Star in AI by VentureBeat in 2019. Marie, welcome to Monster Chats. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good.
Awesome. Thanks so much for jumping on here. I really appreciate you taking time. And I think when I actually took a look at your bio, I was like, wow, she is a badass.
Thank you.
So
yeah, I'm really passionate about tech and stuff and getting involved in things. Just a busy bee.
Yeah. So tell me, before we dig in, just give us a little bit of background. Give us your story. Where did it all started for you?
Where it all started. Well, my mom taught me how to program when I was 9 years old.
Wow. Was your mom a programmer?
Yeah. So I learned how to program basic on a Texas Instruments. I think it was like a TI-7800 or whatever. I forgot what it was called. Mm-hmm. But I learned how to do hexadecimal programming and all this fun stuff because my mom was learning to be a data programmer. And she actually dropped out. My mom is this super genius that didn't know what to commit to. And it really was just kind of a lack of support. Mm. And she just kind of like jumped from these different careers. So she was in the legal field and the medical field and the engineering field.
Well, at that time, was it really tough for women to get in tech?
Yeah. It was tough for her for a lot of reasons. She's multiracial. So it was tough for her just culturally, mm-hmm. Because she wasn't one thing or another. And then she also was a woman, and these are male fields. And she would definitely could have competed. She just didn't have any mentors or support. And so as a young mother, she was just like, well, you know, my kid's bored and needs stuff to do, so let me just show her whatever I'm working on. So whatever she was working on, I was working on. If she was learning, when she learned physiology, I learned physiology. When she learned programming, I learned programming. So I have this kind of obnoxious scientific background. She learned case law and torts and legal. I learned case law, and then I wound up working for legal aid. It was just kind of like this thing my mom and I had going on for a long time about her sharing all her professional pursuits with me on the side as I was going to school.
Wow, that's such a interesting way to grow up, right?
Yeah. They were just, at one point, they couldn't answer any more questions. I had a lot of questions about why the world was the way it was. And so then they were like, books, we have encyclopedias, we have things you can read. And they just kind of, they were like, we got to keep this kid busy because otherwise she's going to keep talking to us.
Yeah. So you had to start getting resourceful to get more of the answers you were looking for, is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
All right. So then what, after growing up as a kid, very curious and, you know, doing things that most kids your age probably had no idea anything about, then kind of what, you know, path did you go down then?
Yeah. So my dad told me in order to get all the things I wanted, mostly clothes from the Gap, I had to get a job. And I think he was kind of half joking. He didn't think I would get a job. And at 15, I got a job. And I wanted working in weekly newspapers. And I did everything. I did sales. I did database work. I learned more about photography. I was a horrible photographer, but I did a lot with the first like digital printing. So like the sort of digital revolution that hit the printing world. Mm-hmm. And it just turned out like that whole thing with the computer skills turned out to be the number one way I would get a job. And so I was like, oh yeah. They're like, do you know computers? And I'm like, yeah, of course. And then they're like, of course. They'd be really shocked. And then I just like would get that job. So my first job was with a couple that ran a weekly newspaper, and it was a great job because I got a sense of like sales. I got a sense of marketing and promotions and photography and so many, you know, what it means to write a story and how to follow a story and all that kind of stuff. It was really fascinating. That led me to really want to get into media and the arts and all that sort of stuff. And then I met there was a guy who had a crush on me in high school, and he said, hey, come see my friend. She goes to USC. Mm-hmm. And my neighbor, and you know, let's go. I was really big on skipping class. Anything I could do to skip class was great, because the whole idea of just like sitting in front, like listening to people talk when I could just read it and be done and be over with, it was just sort of not there. And I was a smart kid. I was valedictorian, actually. Mm-hmm. But I just could not stand being in a class. There's a point where it just became completely, all through high school, pretty much, unless it was a really engaging teacher, there was only a few of those, it was like completely intolerable. So I was notorious for being the smart bad kid in the back, acting up with the bad kids who were flunking out, but I wasn't flunking out.
Oh my gosh. It's so interesting.
And so I was kind of like, okay, well, I'm going to get out of class. Then I learned you could go to college orientations and get out of class. You could join all these clubs and get out of class. So I joined like 20 clubs, and I was always trying to get out of class. So, you know, I couldn't skip school because my dad was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
So skipping school was not an option because I was immediately busted no matter everywhere I went. My dad knew everybody. So it was like the neighborhood. It was his neighborhood. He went to the same high school. So it was just like, there was no chance of me doing anything like that. So I was just kind of like, well, I'll, let me put it together where I can just sort of get out of class. So USC came. That lady knew a guy named John Singleton who went to USC film school and said, you should apply to film school. And I was kind of like, whoa, that sounds like Disney World, but like every day. That was my only reference. And I was a writer, so I was like, can I submit some writing stuff and get in? And they were like, yeah. And weirdly enough, I got in. And so I was the one of 30 out of a pool of like 3,000 that applied.
Wow. And
that got in.
Did you keep skipping class?
Yeah, high school, I skipped class all kinds.
But I'm saying, once you got to USC, were you skipping class?
Oh no! Well, I did have a policy of taking vacation days. I call them vacation weeks. I would take off, like I wouldn't go to class for like a couple weeks at a time, or you know, different things like that. And I did start like studying on the side and doing all kinds of weird stuff on the side. But I knew, you know, USC was so expensive and so intense. I was just kind of like, well, if I drop out of this, I'll be, you know, totally blackballed from the family. So let me just finish and do all that. And then my friends were all kind of working on cool stuff. And so I was kind of like, okay. And then I met, you know, after I got through with my basic classes or whatever, I didn't have that many because when I went to high school, I went to college and high school at the same time. So I had my associates in high school.
Oh, wow. That's very impressive.
Also because it got me out of class. There's like a running thing.
Hey, at least you were skipping class to do something positive, right? I mean, most kids are skipping class to get in my trouble.
It was a positive thing, yeah. So, you know, I had a kind of a free schedule because I did college and high school at the same time that allowed me not to have to sit in front of people every hour. And so USC accepted all those credits. So I got to, you know, after a year and a year, about 6 months, I was into working with faculty, you know, professionals that worked in TV and film, and was able to network and kind of find my way through. And then I decided, I was a comedy nerd. I love the Saturday Night Live. I sort of spent my whole childhood, because I always was like, slept late. I still sleep late. Still a terrible habit I have. And I would watch like David Letterman and all this, you know, Benny Hill and all that stuff. And so I was like, the best job I could think of is to get a job in comedy. So I would follow around all the comedy people at USC Film School and ask them all kinds of questions. And then eventually I got a job with Dennis Miller.
Oh, wow.
And I had interviews though with Larry David and Seinfeld, and I had a chance to talk to the people from Mad TV and a show called Third Rock from the Sun at the time, mm-hmm. and Living Single, and all the shows at that time that were like the hot shows. My mentor was the producer for Gary Marshall and Dick Van Dyke Show. And so he was a comedy legend.
Yeah.
This guy named Sam Denoff. So if you've ever seen Princess Diaries and you've seen The Old Guy, The Old King, that's my friend Sam.
Very my mentor. Cool. So tell so me.
How, he knew a guy named Bernie Brillstein. So that was it.
And so how long did you stay in entertainment, in comedy?
Well, about a year and a half, because this thing called the internet was happening. And I also had an internship with the entertainment company, and they were doing, they were sort of like trying to figure out what to do with this internet thing. And all the old timers in the entertainment business knew it was a thing. And so they had gotten together and they were building a multi million dollar sort of theme park and complex and this whole thing. And then it eventually was based on the Wizard of Oz, and it was a whole sort of dream of reviving that brand with Warner Brothers and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, we became part of AOL and Warner Brothers and all this stuff. And at the time I was like, should I stay in comedy or should I do this tech thing, this tech media tech thing? And all the people at Dennis Miller Live were like, hey, you know, that internet thing's not going to happen again. So you need to jump on that train because it's a real thing, and we're assholes and we'll be here. We're not going anywhere. Like, there's always going to be some weirdo making some jokes and a bunch of people following them around.
That was probably some good advice, right?
Yeah, actually it was. All so, right, so it's kind of like, okay. I get your point.
Yeah,
there'll always be some comedian doing something, and, you know, people will do something else, and it'll always be on video or whatever. You know, at the time, TV was a word. It's not really a word anymore. So I was like, okay, I'm going to jump into this tech thing and see what happens. And I worked my way up to VP by the time I was 25, and wound up running a studio where we worked on like EA games. We worked on one of the first, we worked on FIFA 2000.
Wow.
And we worked on a bunch of videos, music videos, one with Janet Jackson and Busta Rhymes, and the first Hawaiian Tropics video in HD, and the first animation ever on CNN or TV period or something. And so it was all this kind of, you know, fun stuff at the time. It was just sort of like totally roaring hip place. I mean, everybody came to party at our place to see all the computer equipment. We had parties with the computer equipment. and we also scanned bodies for 3D animation. So people would stand in the middle of this thing that looked like a teleporter and get scanned. And that was part of a company with Paul Allen. Rest in peace. And he founded that company, and then they put one of their scanners in our studio. So I was in charge of introducing people to the future, basically. And then, you know, investors would come in and write checks, and celebrities would come in and all these different people would come in. JPL and NASA came in for some consulting. And I mean, it was just a lot of weird, fun things happening all at once because all that stuff was one department. So it didn't matter whether you were doing like a web animation or 3D animation for a movie or a commercial or a music video or AI or, you know, all that kind of stuff, avatar development, it was all in the same department.
Wow, that must have been a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I fell in love with the future. And then I had to go talk to people in the real world after it was over, and it was kind of strange.
Oh, so how long did you stay there, and then what happened next?
I was there, let's see, 5 years about. Mm-hmm. Let's see, 96 to 2000. So yeah, 4 years. So it was a pretty wild ride. I really didn't know what to do. When you've seen like holograms and VR and all this stuff 20 years ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird. I didn't know it was going to be 20 years, but I thought, you know, 5 years at the time, I thought, okay, 5 years from now, everybody will be hip to this stuff. And it some of it still hasn't happened. I was like, okay, I can consult and sort of teach people about these future technologies. And that's kind of a running theme all the way to today, right? It's sort of just having had so much experience with these technologies over the years. Mm-hmm. And helping people understand how they can be commercially implemented and how they can really be profitable and how they can be help their business and that sort of stuff. So I just kind of went from company to company. I worked with this company called MicroStrategy because they were the kings of the data business at the time, and they helped form a company called DoubleClick, mm-hmm. Which Google bought for $4 billion. And so we worked with them right after the DoubleClick stuff and to see kind of what is this data thing about, because it was sort of kind of like data was kind of like the underlying thing that was there. Mm-hmm. And that data conversation kind of continued, and I worked for a company called Rakuten, mm-hmm. Which is Ebates was bought out by Rakuten. But basically everybody kind of knew that this like internet e-commerce thing, data thing, there was a lot of money to be made. There's a lot of way to harness traffic. How do we build out better algorithms? And so there was a lot of us working on those issues, right? And what did it look like? How do you report on it? How do you do all these different things? So I kind of dropped the creative part mm-hmm. of my life because I was like, if you get the infrastructure right, anything can be created. So it's better for me to really understand the infrastructure. So I worked with them, and then Rakuten came along, and I worked with those 2,000 brands and over 2,000 brands, and then another, you know, 1,000 came along after that. And I worked with these two little weird startups called Twitter and Facebook.
Mm. And when was that, when you worked with them?
That was 2009, right before they went public.
Mm. What were you doing? In what capacity were you working with them?
So the Rakuten thing, you know, nobody knew how social media was going to work with advertising. And so we were one of the first companies to ever put together, you know, what do you do to advertise on social media? What does the advertisement look like? What does a promotional tweet look like? How do you work with influencers? So we had an influencer agency we worked with, all that kind of stuff, and just helping them figure out how to monetize a platform. They didn't yet have an ad program.
Mm.
So neither one of them did. They were starting to begin to try to charge for ads. And that was the main story they both needed to go public.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we were doing. So we were featured in different parts of the platform. We, you know, had different forums and things like that. And so, you know, it was just a long discussion. And I started talking to Randy Zuckerberg about data. And she had just quit Facebook because I suspected she didn't want to go on the public company ride and it was going to get crazy. And I was like, hey, you weren't in the network. She's like, oh, that damn movie.
Wow.
So I was kind of like, well, you know, what's the deal with Data and all this? She's like, you're absolutely right. You know, so we, you know, it just came down to the fact that I was like, okay, this is a thing. And then oddly enough, I was actually targeted in a racist incident and wound up having to fight in a law situation with some people. And I wound up working with the ACLU, which was a huge turn in my life. And it sort of stopped everything I was working on and probably a story for a book at some point. But basically, I wound up lobbying in Sacramento. And everyone kept saying the same thing. They kept saying, we need the data to make this change. We don't have the data. Who has the data on this? Because, you know, you could bring in, you know, I don't know if you know how lobbying works, but basically lobbying is really simple. You go, you fly into town, and you walk into the Capitol building of whatever state or in the federal government, and you set up appointments to talk to them. You say, I'm in town for blah, blah, blah. Or you say, I'm here right now, and I need to talk to them right now. And you sort of start talking to them, and, you know, that's what we were doing. And we had all these people, you know, we had all these people ready to talk about, you know, whatever issue. I have experienced this issue. It was terrible. And this is why you need to change it. And the anecdotes were great, but the data was what they wanted more than anything, especially in California.
I kept saying,
are they saying data? That's weird.
So they wanted the data on the issues to validate if it was a real issue or not.
Yeah. To be able to talk to their colleagues about it, people behind the bills, get people writing about the bills, right? And sometimes the bills had been authored, but they weren't necessarily completely fleshed out, or they hadn't passed committee or things like that. So who had the data? So it turned out that I was one of the few people who could find data on the or, you know, the ACLU people had the data, but they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know how to tell a story with it. So I was like, oh, this is a business. This is a business. So that's how Data 360 got formed, actually.
Okay.
From a horrible situation of being racially targeted to forming a data company. That's sort of how it happened. So we came down to San Diego with the ACLU of Southern California and it made a scathing dashboard of all 144 counties in California about police corruption and misspending. Ellie, they're very timely right now, but it was one of the first times it ever happened. And we were featured in the New York Times and the LA Times and PBS and all that stuff.
And this was like 4 or 5 years ago, right?
This was 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was in 2015. My husband and who wasn't my husband at the time, my partner and I, but we got married and then we said, this is a business and let's go on this journey together. And we started sort of like pounding the pavement and like going to co-working spaces and talking to people about data, the internet infrastructure and all this stuff we do now on a regular basis. But we started learning kind of like where people were at and understanding that. And then data-driven became a term that people used and AI started coming out into commercial reality. And then eventually we met Google. And a bunch of Googlers worked with us on different projects and still work with us. And then last year, when I was nominated for that award with VentureBeat, I met the global CTO of Microsoft, Kevin Scott.
Wow.
Who was also an ex-Googler. And I was sort of yelling at him about, why does Microsoft not have a good infrastructure in Los Angeles? And Los Angeles is the second biggest city in the country. And like, what is your problem? And he was like, you're right.
Did you show him the data on that?
No, he knew. He already knew. He was like, yeah, I know. And why don't you talk to my chief of staff and let's get something set up. So he's been really great, you know, in helping us get through the whole infrastructure, Microsoft and sort of stuff. So now we're doing these, you know, pretty major rollouts coming out starting this next month and through August and on forward with Google and Microsoft.
So tell us a little bit more about what is Data 360 and what you guys do.
Yeah, so the way I like to tell people is our superpower, we're like an eHarmony for business. Mm. So everybody knows about algorithms now because of LinkedIn and because of Facebook and all those different tools. And so we actually help businesses build up their communities or manage their communities using data, AI, and machine learning. And it's to help reduce their expenses in managing people. It's also to help create safety and security from public platforms like Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth. So basically, you know, a company or an entrepreneur can have their own social network on their own private system with their own data management where they can see everything, manage everything, talk to everybody, and not have to pay Facebook $700 a lead or $300 a lead by the time they get all the pieces in place to have that person join their community. It's just sort of like there's a point where there's a ridiculous cost. And Google knows that as well. We say Google's like, you're right. And we know our platform's going to go away eventually. but basically, you know, with Google Ads and Facebook Ads, you pay just as tons of money to acquire people. The same with employee acquisition, you pay all this money. Yeah. Where now, because data is so open and because everybody is online, it's much easier to create your own platform and develop your own relationships directly with people without having to go through these proxies.
So how does Data 360 solve that or bridge that gap?
Yeah, so we offer campaign services. We do software integration. We are backwards compatible with the web because we consider AI a separate technology than the web and mobile spaces. So AI is really a back-end infrastructure. It's a data system. It's a set of databases. It's a set of processes in a cloud system. It's not necessarily a website. Mm-hmm. A website is a separate entity. A mobile app is a separate entity. So we help connect the dots between that infrastructure and updating your websites, updating your mobile. So, you know, if you have your own Siri or your own Facebook algorithms or your own LinkedIn algorithms or all that stuff. So we basically make that possible. So some people use it, for example, for we're talking to a retailer, a global retailer, about their loyalty card program. Mm-hmm. How to better manage that. Because right now it's just a dumb card, right?
I know. And nobody ever wants to carry them. They fall off your chain and you're like, what's the point of this damn thing?
Right. So like, and it doesn't know anything about you. It doesn't help you. It's not except on your smartphone.
Except for if you go to CVS and then it's like, hey, here's 52 items that you've never purchased and here's a coupon for it.
Yeah. On a piece of paper that gets wadded up in your pocket and gets, you know, then you put it on your kitchen table and then it's wet and then you're like never see. Then it fades away. You don't even know what it is and it goes in the trash.
I think most people walk out there and just like, are the trees, you're killing the trees.
Yeah. It's actually like, if you think about it, even without AI, if you think about it, it's such a retarded world. So retarded. And so we're just kind of like, hey, we showed it to this global retailer and we went to their headquarters out of the country and we said to them, hey, you know, what's up with all these words on the wall? Like, why are you not talking to people in their smartphone? Like, you're one of the most powerful companies in the world. Like, why don't you have this infrastructure? Mm-hmm. And it turned out that there was just like a lot of fear, right? And so they did want to work with Microsoft, thank God. And so we're working together to try to figure out how do we upgrade this company? Mm-hmm. Because they literally still have CRT monitors inside of their retail and paper signs. And that's just because like they were born out of this era when their founder was like a carny hawking their products in the back of a truck, right? And so like the it's kind of like they're like a European equivalent of Walmart. We might give you a hint of who they are. But they basically, you know, have a headquarters in a little town. And they have this legacy system that is not very smart, but they have billions of customers. Mm-hmm. And they don't have, you know, their Facebook page barely works, you know, wow. And that sort of stuff. And that's just because, you know, they don't have enough know-how. Right. And so then there's this issue that we also saw where, you know, there's not enough talent. There's not enough tech talent to help people upgrade. There's not enough knowledge. Something like 50 to 75% of the workers have to be retrained. So like, we're even working with Microsoft on how to develop new curriculum and upskill the workforce globally, because if we don't, all the tech companies are screwed.
Mm.
So we have a division of our company called Data 360 Labs. It just does that with entrepreneurs and with the workforce.
Very cool.
And helps people like experiment with AI, learn about AI, get internships, get apprenticeships. So we have a big expansion of that with Microsoft coming up in August.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a big deal with corporations. I mean, we were talking with some people from Liberty Mutual and Johnson & Johnson. They've all had to remake their companies. And there's always a huge, you know, they're in Boston. So everybody's trying to compete for MIT and Harvard talent, and not everybody can get them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then what do you do? There has to be a company or a series of companies that can help fill that gap when they can't, you know, find the right talent or know how to connect the dots on how to impact, how the ROI is impacted, how it's going to change their companies. Like, what does it really mean? They don't have any of that leadership. That leadership, there's still quite a void in that leadership. So there's like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and companies, really a handful, less than a dozen companies like us that are going through and saying, okay, the future, right? And everybody goes, yeah. We go, well, you need to prepare for it. And they go, yeah. And then COVID came along. Mm. And now it's on acceleration mode because you can't do everything physically anymore. You know, people are sort of holding on to physical interactions with their, you know, you're going to have to rip it from my dead paws. I'm still going to go out to that conference. I'm going to go to that party. They're like, you might die. And they're like, okay, well, yeah. You might die, right? But, you know, the reality is everybody needs to change out their infrastructure to be more resilient and flexible for changes, you know, climate change and COVID and all these things that may happen. And that's really apparent right now, so.
Wow, yeah. So things are just moving way faster than they would, which is a good thing. You know, there's some change that needs to happen, and now it's happening faster than it would have otherwise.
Yeah.
What's been some of the biggest challenges as an entrepreneur in starting your company?
Besides the whole black woman thing. which is a whole conversation everybody's having right now. Mm-hmm. There was sort of let's see. I mean, there's so many answers to that question. What's challenging about it?
Well, what does the data say?
What does the data say? Well, yeah. It says less than 1% of us get funded. 1% of 1%. I think I just heard today the average black woman gets $42,000 in investment. We've had 50. The rest of it's come from revenue. Fortunately, because, you know, I have a very unique expertise. My co-founders are very unique people as well. One works for Intel, one's from the insurance business. Because of our unique combination, we've been able to make revenue from day one, even though it hasn't always been easy. It hasn't always been profitable. We're right on the verge of being absolutely profitable with $50,000 of investment, which has been amazing. So, but yeah, I mean, there's kind of, you know, investors are equally technologically ignorant. and so outside of San Francisco, it's very difficult to have people understand technologies like AI, or even if they do, it's kind of this anecdotal weird thing. A lot of people, so-called experts, especially here in Los Angeles, like they just don't have any technical chops at all. So trying to start a software company in Southern California was like extremely difficult. And once we got backing from Google, once we got backing secondly from Microsoft, that sort of put us in a different class of company and allowed us to roll through and get more corporate partners. So we're also a Thinkific partner, a Shopify partner, all this sort of stuff. So all those partnerships actually allowed us to circumvent all the problems in the VC world, all the problems in the investor world that don't, where they're just technically whatever, and then they fall back on this interpersonal BS, right? Mm-hmm. About do I like you? Can I hang out with you in a bar? Can I? And I'm just like, how about we just make money? And like, why do I have to hang out with you in a bar? And all this sort of bonding ritual stuff. Even though I have to say, you know, Google and Amazon did a bang up job in taking us out to dinners, fancy dinners, big dinners. But
the dinner's nice, but where's the check, right?
Yeah. They gave us the swag and the dinners and the whatever. Well, Microsoft wrote the check, and I was really impressed with that. So Microsoft was like, here's a check, and here's a bigger check if you're ready. Here's more. And actually meet all our people. They weren't worried about the dinners, but Google and Amazon did a lot of dinner things. And gave us, my in-laws got a Ring doorbell out of it. And my kids got backpacks and Google minis and all that kind of stuff. But, having someone actually just write the check without all that BS is really helpful. I really appreciate Microsoft sort of stepping up to the plate. We'll see if Google steps to the plate. We've been talking to them about their Black Founder program. We just sent out some information about that a couple days ago or yesterday, whatever day it is. I don't know what day it is anymore. VCs were a huge problem. VCs are a problem.
Yeah.
And now we're technically a VC with our incubator program. We work with VCs.
I mean, I think that Data 360 can maybe help solve that problem.
Yeah, we can, because, and that's what got us involved is because when we started working with small businesses, we had a unique view on how product market fit works. Because we could see into the matrix. I mean, we could see the whole internet genome going by. We could tap into all these APIs. So we can really see, is this a real viable business? Are there real people talking about it? And in what context can this be sold? And so that's what we're known for now. And we're, expanding greatly now our curriculum around how can businesses determine product market fit? How can they be profitable? Is there really a market for that? I always make a joke that, someone wants to know about, how do you hang out with a purple kitty cat on Tuesday while drinking coffee? There's a cat cafe in Japan where you could actually do that. And here's where it is and here's how it goes. And, you can sell to those people. There are literal things like that. And VCs just kind of talk off the top of their head about what they know and what their friends know. They don't really know much about the market. They really haven't done a lot of data analysis. There's sometimes some bigger firms that do a lot of research. But most of the bulk of the, the best of the best do their research and they have firm theses and things like that. But those are all the ones in Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road. And they have very, very strong opinions about certain things. And they also, build out relationships. And sometimes they just get to know you and get educated over time. And that's how they invest. But they don't really know anything. They don't really have the data or the background. So, we've been working. Now we have a network of about 100 or so investors that we know where we can share that kind of information. And then we have one of our first companies we've groomed going through, that's going to start going through the pitch process. So we're very excited about that. And we can show the data behind what they're talking about. But, it takes time, it takes effort. It's not the same as a usual pitch competition or a demo day. You really have to dig. We have to dig into what the customers are really talking about. And so we've done that now with many, many businesses, and it's always an interesting process to kind of see what it reveals, because sometimes they go, how did you know that? And I go, I don't know anything, and neither do you. This is what the data says. This is what it is. This is, you know, and they're like, well, where's the person? Well, it's like, here's a person. Their name is Bob. They live in North Carolina. He has two pets, and he's in your market. And here's how.
Wow.
And that part freaks people out.
Oh, yeah.
Because they've never been able, you know, Google and Amazon and Facebook don't allow you to see that information. Mm-hmm. Of where the algorithms are making the match. And we actually provide that visibility. We can show you the person. We usually, you know, don't reveal we never reveal their private information until they've opted in to a campaign, or they've opted to say, yes, I want to be a part of this community. But people are freaked out. We show them the picture of the person, you know, their first name, they're from this city, this is how they're involved, and people just lose it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. We're going to take a quick break just to tell you what we do here at Monster VoIP. We started Monster VoIP, frankly, because we're sick and tired of getting gouged on our business phone bills and getting dropped calls. Today, we serve a little over 6,000 customers nationwide, and we're passionate about serving businesses, saving them money, and giving them the tech stack that they need for their phone system. You can text info to 424-378-6966 to learn more. Maria, it's been fantastic getting to know things that are just mind-blowing about Data 360 and your journey that got you to you know, founding that company. So tell me, what's next? What are the plans for you guys for the next 1, 5, or 10 years?
I always feel like Pinky in the Brain. Next, the world. It actually is. It is the world next. But we're very excited about the relationship with Microsoft and growing our footprint with them and also with Google. And what we're focused on now is, what's called skilling, which is all this upskilling stuff that needs to happen for the whole world. It needs to happen for so many different reasons, right? So it needs to happen just in general with the workforce. It needs to happen because of neural diversity, people with different disabilities and mental predispositions. And it needs to also happen because of social and economic justice. And so we're working, we're so excited that they're very passionate about that. People don't know, but Microsoft is one of the few companies where African Americans and women actually have equal pay and equal support and all that stuff. And so they're passionate about debuting that. They sort of like have kept a lot of things under the rug about their company, because I just had kind of this like adversarial relationship with them in my mind because of Windows.
Is there any under the rug information?
I really had feelings about that.
Any under the rug information you can give us about the LinkedIn algorithm?
Yeah, it's based on 20 models, 20 different points of action. That's how they do it with their machine learning. We actually have 100 plus models that we use to do our algorithm matching. So we're a lot more robust in that way. Wow. We're excited to be a part of their whole family with OpenAI and LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. So our roadmap is really there. I mean, I don't know if, we'll ultimately spin out as a kind of a separate entity truly after this point, or we'll just stay kind of attached to those two, or what will happen with, it's interesting with OpenAI, kind of has the same interesting dilemma. And I think all the corporations have learned that VCs are full of it too. And so they've kind of created relationships with early startups. So that was, one of the reasons why I was saying about young companies being able to partner with corporations. Mm-hmm. There are these partner programs and these support programs that are, in a lot of ways, more powerful than a VC writing a check and saying, hurry up and show me what you can do.
Yeah, what sort of resources and value do they get by by going that path?
Yeah, so they, you know, you get mentors, you get direct access to the executive teams, you get, dollars, actual credits. They have VC arms. They have their own VC arms. They have their own partners. they have these whole mega ecosystems. And so some people think it's a little bit monopolistic. But at the same time, I have to say they're healthier networks than VC networks. That's been our experience. They're a lot healthier because they're based on commerce. They're not based on this interpersonal stuff. They're not heavily, it's heavily biased. They just want to know, can you do the job or can you not do the job? They don't screen you all crazy like they do with employment. They don't stalk you. They just want to know, can you make money with us or can you not make money with us? And they give you lots of time and lots of bandwidth and lots of support to do it. And I think that's the best, you know, that's the best way you can, you know, have is that's what you should have with a VC, but you don't have that. A lot of VCs write the check and then they disappear because they need to write the next check. So yeah, you get a ton of resources. You get a whole ecosystem. And in the case of Microsoft, it's 50-year-old ecosystem. It's a lot. We've been actually, we kind of got overwhelmed in the beginning.
Yeah.
Because there was so much that they threw at us. And say, but can you do something with this? I still have about two or three divisions, sort of inquiries with Microsoft that we haven't gotten back to yet.
Well, this has been awesome learning about your journey and about Data 360. Before I let you go, just tell people where they can connect with you online, where they can learn more.
Yes, I'm on the LinkedIn. Under Marie Data 360, on Facebook under Marie Data 360, on Instagram under Marie Data 360. And then, you know, if you want to contact the company about any projects or anything, support at data360.solutions.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Marie. If you're listening to the podcast, please subscribe, share with your friends, and we're listening for your feedback. The show is all about you. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Sessions by Monster Chats, presented to you by Monster VoIP. Monster VoIP started, frankly, because we were sick and tired of getting gouged on our business phone bill and getting dropped calls all of the time. Today, Monster VoIP serves over 6,000 customers and is passionate about saving businesses money and giving them the features that they need in a modern tech stack for today's companies. Text TRIAL to 424-378-6966 to get your free trial of Monster VoIP.